Hello, and welcome to another Sound Test bonus interview, where this time I'm joined by Tim Wright, also known as Cold Storage. Tim's a truly legendary composer, who started off his career with Amiga titles like Lemmings, before moving on to varied work across several systems and genres. In this talk, we focus on his music for Wipeout, and sound design for racing games in general. Originally, this interview was planned to appear in my upcoming racing special, but due to its length and detail, I decided to release it on its own, and you can hear me realise that in this conversation. This is simply one of the best and most candid chats I've recorded for the Sound Test, and I hope you enjoy it ahead of lots more racing insight to come in ST2. So thank you very much for giving your time today. Hope you're all right.
Yeah, I'm good. I've ordered my pizza, so that should be here in about 40 minutes.
No problem.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, no problem. I'll try and get as much as I can in before then.
Oh, it's okay. I can keep talking. It'll just be me munching away.
No, that's fine by me. right, so I thought, because I've got some questions about your work on the Amiga and stuff later down the line, but because I'm working on the racing special like right now, I thought we'd start out with some of the Wipeout stuff.
Yeah, no problem.
So because of your work on the Amiga for ages, though, like you'd been working in like classic VGM and with old samples on four channels and everything, so when the PlayStation came along and all the CD audio, obviously it was quite a big leap in what was available to you. But I wondered how much these big electronic soundtracks for those Wipeout games were like coming from the developers or coming from your own like evolution of approaching music. Like how much were the developers saying to you, right, push this system to its limits?
To be honest, because it was an early title for the platform, everyone was in at the deep end. So prior to the main announcement, because Sony had a sizable chunk of Psygnosis already, we got the dev kits early. So we had a bit of a head start. But largely, people were very much concerned about, you know, their little niche. The coders were trying to fathom out how it worked. I guess the graphic artists, they had a bit of a shock, because in some respects, it's like, well, hey, you know, we're doing 3D now. And in other respects, you haven't got much texture RAM. So if you compare the quality of graphics on something like a similar PC game or even an Amiga top-end game, admittedly 2D, but you compare the quality of graphics and then you take a look at a PlayStation 1 early title, there's no comparison. Yeah, it's in 3D, but it's a bit grubby looking. So I think everybody had their mind on their speciality initially, but when it came to the point of, okay, we want sound for this new racing game, Nick Burkham, who was, you know, the lead designer on that, he had a vision, really, about which way it should go. Not particularly with the sound effects, but certainly from the music perspective. He had been coming up with ideas for this. He'd roped in one of the artists to render some initial stuff that went into the film Hackers. So that all kind of happened at the same time. And he was well into his he'd just come out of the clubbing era, you know, acid house, all that kind of thing. And his musical tastes were heading in the electronic style, anything that was kind of dancey, fast-paced, that kind of thing. Meanwhile, I'd just come out of a game called Crazy Ivan, and that was, I think it was maybe only one game prior to that where I'd been called upon to produce CD quality audio. There was a slightly unsuccessful game called No Escape, based on the film by Sony Pictures, starring Ray Liotta if you search for No Escape, you get a completely different film. I mean, this was, this didn't do too well. But Graham Revell did the music for that, and it was very orchestral, and I was lucky enough to get all the stems of all his orchestral stuff, so it was a blend between my take on and his stuff. So that was the first CD audio stuff I did, but it was very classical. Then I went into Crazy Ivan, and they wanted something robotic and industrial to go with the whole theme of the thing. So I was going in the Nine Inch Nails direction, or Marilyn Manson, that kind of thing. And then to go from that to, okay, which isn't a style I'd written in before. So I was taking cues from all sorts of different places, the musicians I've just mentioned, and the likes of like Blade Runner and so on. And then to go from that into Wipeout, where I'm being told, okay, we want stuff like Left Field, Orbital, who else of that era? I'm just trying to think of the
Prodigy
references. Clearly Prodigy, yeah. My mind's drawn a blank
Brothers.
Now. But, where was he? No, I don't think at that point in time, but they certainly came on the scene afterwards as a potential inclusion. But yeah, the Orb and so on. Anything that was of that era and the bands that had that were moving on from the whole acid house side of things and were starting to play big venues, you know, like Glastonbury and stuff like that. Produce something along these lines. So I think the first track I produced was a bit industrial sounding because I'd just come from doing the Crazy Ivan track. And I think Nick was a bit unsure. So I said, look, give me a couple of weeks and we'll, you know, see where we're at. And then there was a move of building to go from the Albert Dock in Liverpool to Wavertree Tech Park, which is a bit further inland. So there was all that got in the way. But I got a brand new, an actual music studio this time, rather than just a large room in a vacuous warehouse. to give you an idea, that's where the name Cold Storage came from. In this back room in an old converted warehouse where there was no false ceiling. So you just looked up and 25, 30 feet above you was just literally, kind of corrugated roofing. And that's how the natural light came in. There were no windows. And it was icy cold in there. In summer it was nice and cool, but in winter it got really cold. So I joked to one of the programmers who I was providing sound effects for a particular game. After about an hour of chatting, I said, great, I think I know what I'm doing now. I'll see you later. I'm back off to Cold Storage. And he laughed. And then I actually put Cold Storage on the door just to, you know, sort of rub the noses of management in. Can I have a heater, please? The name stuck. And then when they were asking me, weeks later, I actually think it was Nick. He said, what should we put as, do you want to go as Tim Wright for this music? Because we've got all these licensed acts and it'd be good if you had some kind of presence. I said, I said, why not Cold Storage? And he said, what? I said, back in the building. It's a bit naff. I said, good as anything. Duran Duran sounds a bit naff to me, but they're okay, they're doing okay. So that was it. And then one of the other graphic artists, I said, can you do me a logo? And he said, okay, what's the name? And I said, Cold Storage. And he went, oh god, okay then. The logo he produced, for some reason he made the O's small. And then I just went with that. So wherever you see Cold Storage, it's capital letters with lowercase O, or sometimes the O is a dot, literally a full stop, or a period, as they say in the States. I've digressed a lot, but I just thought I'd throw it in while I'm thinking about things.
Yeah, that's cool.
So to Alt-Tab, back to your original question, which will mean nothing to Mac users, but anyway. After the 2 weeks of moving, I'm in the new studio, which we got to spec out. They spent thousands on it, which is great. We got custom desks, everything. Deadlines were looming a bit. So I just went at it, hammer and tong. I ordered a load of sample CDs. I have to say, first and foremost, there was two CDs by a company called Time and Space. I think they're still trading. And they produced Volume 1 and Volume 2, their very first two sample CDs. And if you can't buy those anymore, but if you can find them, I think, on the internet, and you listen to the samples on those two CDs, you'll go, oh my god, that's in Wipeout, that's in Wipeout, that's in Wipeout. So that was very sort of driving force, all those kind of sounds. And then listening to the likes of Chemical Brothers, Orbital Left Field, and so on. And I spent a solid, I'd say 2 to 3 weeks in really hot summer weather, driven by Red Bull, which I just thought was a fruity drink. And after consuming 8 in a row to quench my thirst, and I was climbing the walls, my colleague, the musician Mike Clark, told me that they had caffeine in, and that's why I was grinding my teeth and going, can you hear it, Mike? Can you hear the beat? Yeah, embarrassing. So, yeah, they just kind of flowed out. Back in those days, it wasn't a digital audio workstation. It wasn't a DAW, as we use now. I used Propellerhead Reason and have done for a while. Back then, it was an Amiga running bars and pipes, and that was driving all sorts of external synthesizers. So, yeah, the sampler got a lot of use, an Akai S2800. And then a lot of those squelchy sounds that you hear in the Wipeout tracks, you know, the filtered sort of wow, they're coming from a Roland JD800. So that's another sort of driving force within the sound. There are even some Amiga samples in there. So that was like a perfunctory nod back to the past. A few of the kick drums, maybe some of the crunchy hi-hats. Yeah, so Nick came in, listened to a couple of the tracks and went, wow, yeah, you found the direction. Keep going and just do as many as you can. So we had 3 licensed tracks and then I padded it out. And then there were a couple of versions of Wipeout where we couldn't license, or for certain territories we couldn't license. So I had to sit down and create a few more tracks. Yeah, I think that's answered your original question.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, that's a really good, like, total story of the whole thing, really.
Well, there we go. We've set the kind of the background, the backdrop.
Well, how much of a fan were you of that kind of mid-90s electronic stuff that was going on?
Hated it. Well, that's a strong word. I think I didn't like the scene. I didn't appreciate it. I thought the whole acid house smiley face taking drugs, it was for kids. I didn't really get it. Which I think, how old was I at that point? Early 30s, was I? Or late 20s. But honestly, my musical brain was entrenched in the 80s. Howard Jones, Nick Kershaw, these kind of solo guys that had made it big with synthesizers and singing along, and you know, like I guess a few of the bands as well, Tears for Fears, Orchestral Moves in the Dark, to a degree Kraftwerk, but not so much. But all that kind of definitely Jar. I mean, his stuff. I've always had a thing for his music, so my background was definitely electronic, lots of synthesizer sounds, but always melodic. Everything has a melody. Everything is a song. It's not necessarily an instrumental thing. But then, you know, that goes against the fact that I like Jar. So, you know, there's the occasional vocal sample, but not much else. So, yeah, it took a while. When I was writing the stuff for Crazy Ivan in that industrial style, I hadn't done that before. That was just interesting. It was a challenge. But honestly, I panicked when I listened to a lot of the reference material that Nick gave me for Wipeout, because not all of it, but some of it was literally just boots, cuts, boots, you know, or boots, 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 and this squelching bass, and the filter cutoff just changed over like 9 minutes. And there was literally nothing else there. That was it. And I was thinking, why would you listen to this? It's inane. But I thought, well, people do, and that's where Nick wants to go, so let's go there. And I didn't get there. I did not achieve that. What I ended up with, there was a graphic artist there, Nikki Westcott, as she was then, and she came up and was into the whole, I mean, she worked on Wipeout and she was interested in what I'd done. So I played her some of the tracks and she said, was that just one track? I said, yeah. She goes, there's about 8 tracks in that one track. You sort of do something for about 15, 20 seconds. There's a bit of a musical break or a rhythmic break. Then you're into another song. Then maybe you go back to song one. Then you're back to song two. Then there's another song. Essentially, I mean, they're all the same BPM, the same key, but you could, she said, you could just take each one of those sections and stretch them out to an entire song. And I said, yeah, I could, but I'm too scared because I think it's dull. And I, that if you listen to the tracks from Wipeout 1, you'll hear that. It's like there's a theme, then it goes to another theme, then it goes to another theme. And I think that's why they sound, they do stand out. They're different to the other acts that are on there. And I eventually did get it though, just to sort of go on from, to lead on from your question. I was dragged forcibly out to various nightclubs and to what I thought was to endure this music. But what actually happened was I did it. I understood what it was all about. I didn't take drugs. I just drank water. And my usual experience of going out to a club was you go out, you get absolutely hammered, whiskey, beer, whatever. Have a laugh, have a joke, maybe get a kebab on the way home, and that's a good night out, and you wake up in the morning with a headache. But that wasn't the atmosphere. Yeah, okay, so a few people were taking ease and whatnot, but they were just drinking water. Very little alcohol consumed. And I thought, well, let's give this a go. Just, you know, drink the water because you're dancing a lot, which really wasn't my thing. But then I understood what it was. When you're in a venue and the kick drum is literally vibrating your body, and you've got that squelchy bass that's just slowly changing, and then you've got another instrumental part that's slowly building, and then it goes down again, and then it builds even higher and it goes down again. You're kind of willing it to get further and get higher, and it sounds corny. You become one with the music.
It is almost like primal.
It is, very. And it keys into that whole lizard brain thing, and you don't even realise you're there. You're kind of having your own solo experience. So I would imagine, I don't condone drugs, kids, but I would imagine with an E, all your physical sensations are heightened. You know, someone touches you and it just sort of goes right through your body and so on. So yeah, it's trippy. The whole thing is, you know, hence trans techno, you know, I kind of got it just in that one evening. But this was, I would say, towards the end of writing the tracks. So then when you go to Wipeout 2097, when I wrote the music for that, I only wrote 2 tracks. They are just one theme, and it kind of goes that way. So it was a pivotal moment. It changed my understanding. Yeah, and so if I was to try and write music in the style of Wipeout 1 again, it would be difficult.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's 25 years ago now, isn't it, really, as well?
Oh, great, yeah. no, it is, yeah. It's a while ago. But yeah, everybody moves on as well. But yeah, again, I've waffled, but the...
No, it's all perfect. I mean, I don't know how much you know about the format of my show, but like all of this gets edited up into like a documentary format anyway, so...
Oh, well, like, that's fine then.
Your questions will probably end up as like 5 different segments.
Okay, yeah, cool.
Yeah, which is all really good for me. I mean, the longer the answers are, the better, frankly.
Well, you've got more to choose from.
Yeah, precisely. So you talked a little bit about the equipment you were using and synths and things like that. And I was particularly interested because obviously there is kind of this big step up from working with the Paula chip on the Amiga to kind of essentially being able to do what you want on a CD audio kind of thing. So were you like consciously bringing in new synths, new drum machines, new equipment? And if so, what kind of was the real new stuff that you were bringing in?
Yeah, it wasn't, truthfully, it wasn't, I'm working on Amiga, and even when it gets to like Mega Drive and even Mega CD and other console formats that someone had c- cunningly written module drivers for. So you could, you know, you could write it on the Amiga, and it would work on the Amiga, the ST, the Mega Drive, Saturn, and so on and so on and so on. In the background, certainly in my kind of like my, in my house, in my private studio, although, you know, it's a bit of a grand term really, I had the early beginnings of a synth-based studio. So I bought a Kawai K1 while I was still in that tin sheet cold storage place, and I was beginning to write with a band, a friend of mine. We'd formed a band called Redshift, and so that was going on in the background, and then I wanted something that was multi-timbral, so it could do the drums and the bass and so on and so on. So I bought myself a Korg 01RW, which is like a rack version of the Korg 01, which is the successor to the very, very famous Korg M1. And while I was sort of getting up to speed with that, I was still writing Amiga music. So when it came to then transitioning into bizarrely doing orchestral first, I thought, yeah, I can do this. And I didn't put any pressure on Psygnosis to bring it, you know, buy new equipment. I just brought in my Korg, my Kawai. We got bars and pipes. And I started writing the music that way. And I had no clue about mastering, EQ, compression. This was something I had to sort of learn on the fly, which was fun. So that was the beginnings. Then Psygnosis got burgled,
right?
And my Korg was stolen, my Kawai was stolen. Luckily Mike and I, as the two musicians, always took our Amigas home, so that was fortunate. And then when we told management, hey, look, we were burgled, you're replacing all the computers for everybody, that's great, but Mike and I had our own synthesizers in. Well, what were you doing leaving them at work? Well, we use them in our work. Well, that's not right. So they recompensed us for our losses, and I just bought the same equipment again. Actually, no, I got a Kawai K1 Mark II, which was nice, built-in sound effect, built-in effects, in reverb and so on. But then they said, look, come up with a list of equipment you think you need, and we'll get it. So that was great. So I think I got, really foolishly, a Gem S2 keyboard, which, sorry Gem, but it was a bit rubbish. The demo sounded good, but when you try to use it kind of in anger, using it for a project, the synthesis engine actually wasn't that great. So that got sold pretty quickly. Then there was the move to Wavertree, which I've covered. And when we got there, it was, okay, we need to be pro now. So what do you guys want? And we consulted with an expert who had built recording studios for the BBC. He advised a particular build for the size of space that we had. That was built over a period of, it took a while actually, I think. Best part of a month. This is really weird. I don't remember smells too much. You know, sometimes like Play-Doh when you were a kid and you know, your grandmother's perfume and so on. But I remember the smell of those studios. It never went away. It was a cross between pine and this bizarre glue that they used to stick the things on the walls. So, hey, I don't know. Maybe I was permanently high every day. But yeah, so we got desks built, custom built out of MDF, and sprayed this kind of like crazy deep purple color. And then we just opened a pad and pen, and we bought loads of magazines because the internet was a bit lacking in that kind of department, sort of late 90s. And we just went through all the reviews and, like, okay, this looks good, this looks good. We definitely need a sampler. We didn't buy the same equipment. Mike got what he wanted and I got what I thought was a good idea. So yeah, Amiga, bars and pipes, that was driving everything that was MIDI. I had a Yamaha Pro 01, what was the stuff at the end, WFD or something like that, but basically it was a digital mixing desk, 16 channels, with the motorized faders, which always looks sexy in a recording studio. but essential, because you know, when you're working on one song, then you want to go back and work on another one, you press a button, all the sliders just jump to where they should be for that particular song. So it's great from that perspective. And then in terms of synthesizers, there was the Roland JD800, there was the Akai S2800. I bought another Korg O1RW at work, because that obviously meant I was familiar with it. There was I can't remember the name of this thing, but it was a Korg synthesizer with a small keyboard. And it was one of the first synths that could do kind of like a computer-generated version of real instruments like flutes and oboes and cellos and all that kind of thing. If you Google for that, you'll find it, whatever it's called. I keep thinking it's called the Pro One, but it's not. That's a really old synth. I'm just starting to think if there was anything else really at that time. I think that was the mainstay. And an Apple Mac Quadra 650. And all that was used for was, I think, Lotus Notes and sampling. So actual CD mastering. So, you know, all of this flies into the Mac Quadra. And I did a bit of sort of compression and EQing on there. And then if I wanted a CD pressing, I waited for ages to get my own CD burner. It wasn't classed as a priority, apparently, because we could go down to the computer games test department and get them to burn a CD. And in fairness to them, bless them, they were good. I said, look, hey, can you burn me a CD and keep one for yourself? Because they were into the music anyway. So it wasn't a direct sort of stop doing Amiga music, start doing amazing, the best you can for CD audio. It was a sort of gentle transition, encouraged by my work at home on my own gear. But nevertheless, it was a little bit, I guess it was a little bit baptism by fire at first, but then I just got excited by the fact that I had free rein, and the only nagging doubt I ever had was, is it going to be good enough? And I would constantly be A-B-ing, I'd just pick some trance techno at random, play it on my system in the studio, and then cut to my music and just sort of go, okay, are the kicks a bit loud, is there enough bass, is there too much bass, dynamics, so I think that kind of covers it.
Absolutely. And you mentioned maybe not thinking about EQ and all that kind of thing so much at the time and worrying if it was good enough. You've obviously come later down the line, done the Slipstream remix albums. So I did want to ask a little bit about how it felt to come back and revisit that stuff and what kind of stuff you were doing to pep it up.
Yeah, okay. So this is it's one of those hindsight things. So the main thing at first was because things were getting really popular in terms of people wanting to listen to it. I put it out on a few, I think initially I just put it out there, the originals on my website for downloading. You just get them for free. And then I thought I really should tackle these and make them sound a little bit better. So there was a mid stage. So there's the originals. Then there was a mid stage remaster, which I didn't really make a big song and dance about. And I think I sold, if memory serves, I sold those directly from my website. Because my day job's working with websites, so I just did a sort of a PayPal portal thing. And then when it got to the point that there was Bandcamp and potentially, a record label or something like that, I thought I really need to give these a lick of paint. And try and get them to sound as good as possible. So, yeah, well, what's the craziest you can go on these sound systems? So, I think I'm right in saying I did them at 64-bit, 192 kilohertz. And I kind of did, but didn't. So let me explain that. The original tracks, the original stems, they are lost to time. If I had a time machine, I could go back and get them. But I only had the final mixes. And reason being, I have the MIDI files, so I have all the note triggering. I had access to Time and Space, those sample CDs that I used, I didn't at the time when I did the remasters have access to a JD800, but I do now. I bought one recently, just for old time's sake. Yeah, so I could have reconstructed them. It would have been painstaking, and it probably wouldn't have sounded the same. So the technique I actually used was I took the CD quality backups that I had. Well, actually, DAT, they're on DAT, so they're 48 kilohertz. So they're a little bit better and a bit more headroom. And I EQ'd them. Well, firstly, I upsampled them to the 64-bit, 192 kilohertz. And then I used various tools to... You can... There's software tools where you can select certain bands within a recording and concentrate on those and EQ them, and you can do like a sidechain process where you're leveling the mix in different bands, different frequency bands. So I did some experimentation doing that, and yeah, I quite liked the results. So that's kind of like one main aspect of what happened. And in fact, I also, where I didn't think that there was enough of a fade out on some of the tracks, I would actually take the final section, ramp it as a fade up. So essentially it's a fixed level, which means I can loop it and then fade it out again. So there were a few of those. It wasn't just a case of just upsample, bit of EQ, compression, okay, that sounds better. There was some TLC, and some of the mixes were extended and so on. But, yeah, looking back with hindsight in whatever year it is I did those, was it 2007 or something? Listening to the original mixes that were actually in the game, they were okay. They weren't brilliant with the knowledge I'd gained over that many years. They were a little bit muddy, needed a little bit of top. They certainly benefited from that. But this is the irony. So when I was at that point looking back and thinking, yeah, you didn't do too badly there, Tim, but we can improve upon this. And I did those remasters. When I listen to those remasters now, I can hear, that could be improved. That's a little bit bright. All the mixes are maybe a little bit bright. That's good for a lot of people's sort of systems they're playing back on. Maybe they're using like a boom bar or whatever. But if they're on really good quality headphones, maybe. You know what I mean? I'm having this internal conversation with myself. So I would do it differently again now. But you can go back too many times. So I think I'm at peace with the fact that there's that version that people can listen to. And for people who are purists and just want to listen to the originals, it's there. They're out there. You know, you just need a copy of the game. And you can rip the CD. So, yeah, that was the mindset. Anyway.
Is that feeling you have about the Slipstream remixes then why you went on to do the Chill Out ones as well? There's a chance to maybe look at it in another way.
It doesn't really have any bearing on the Slipstream stuff, which, in fact, brings me to a point. I wish I'd just called that Wipeout, not Slipstream. I was nervous about calling it the Wipeout album or the music from Wipeout, just from a legal standpoint. But having spoken to the legal department at Sony, they were like, "Yeah, wouldn't have mattered. You could." So yeah, and then I got talking to them about various other projects and stuff. So you know, we're on good terms, and I could have just done that. I was tempted at one point to rename them, but they've been out there a while now. People know that. You know, that's what they're called. But Chill Out was another thing. What happened? I think I'm living in Switzerland now, but I was back visiting North Wales. I was driving along in the car and I had my phone Bluetoothed and I was listening to one album, and then it just, I have the Wipeout tracks on there anyway. And it went into, I think it was Message, And that started up, and I thought, oh God, no, I'm not listening to my own music. But I was on the motorway and I didn't want to fiddle, so I thought, oh, I'll just leave it play then. Because I think it was only another 15 minutes to go before I could go into the services anyway. I needed fuel. And it had been a long time since I'd listened to Message. And I just got... And the sun was setting and it was coming to the end of the day. I'd just flown. I was in a rental car. I was tired. It was a late night flight. And, it was a nighttime flight by the time I got to Wales, you know, middle of summer, sun setting. And I just thought, if you did this at halftime, half the BPM, you could do like a chilled version of this track. That might work quite well. And that planted the seed. And then that idea popped back into my head. Oh, wow, I think a year later? Maybe not that long. And... So then I listened to all the tracks and thought, yeah, I could do that with that track, that with that track. And with about four or five of these tracks, I had a solid idea of how I would do a chilled version. So then, that's a whole other story, that whole chill out debacle. Anyway, yeah, so it was nothing to do with Slipstream. It was literally just that chance moment. Driving late, accidentally listening to my own music, only because I couldn't switch it off. and it was such a chance occurrence.
Well, from hearing you talk about it as a debacle like that, I'm almost scared to try and get into that, considering how many questions I have otherwise.
If that's one of your questions, then fire away.
Well, no, I didn't realise it was a debacle, but you've piqued my interest.
I'll go on then. I thought it was a good idea. I started writing some of the tracks. I'm not blowing my own trumpet, to use a musical metaphor, but I thought they were good. I thought, these are good. I think this is going to work. Because that's a test for me. If I write something and I'm willing to listen to it, just to listen to it, then, you know, it's people go, oh, isn't it a bit big-headed listening to your own music and enjoying it? It's like, well, no. You go into the kitchen and you think, oh, really fancy. Something really straightforward. Beans on toast. So you go in, you cut a nice chunky bit of bread, you lather it in salted butter, you get your favourite tin of beans, whether you like Heinz or whatever, Branston beans or whatever. You cook those. Maybe you like them slightly overdone in the microwave so they're a bit softer. You get those on top. You like a really strong, cheddar, cave aged or whatever. So you grate a load of that on top. And maybe you're like me, you're perverse. You like a big dollop of mayonnaise on the side as well. And you sit down and you eat that and you're just like, this is the nectar of the gods.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't say to somebody, but you made that. You shouldn't be just eating the food that you make and going, oh, I did a good job here. So it's I like to think of it that way. If you sit down and you write a piece of music the way you would want it to be heard and in a way that you enjoy, then hearing it again should be a pleasure. You know, it should be something you want to do. I mean, not day after day after day. There is, you know, like they say on the BBC, there are other brands out there. But to come back to it 6 months later or a year later and think, oh, yeah, that for a while and listen to your own music, I don't see a problem. So again, I digress, but I had three or four tracks. I thought, okay, let's introduce this to the public as an idea, which I did tentatively. Response was good, and then I thought, I'm going to do a real good job on this. I'm going to do a proper CD, double CD, sort of triple fold with a poster inside, custom artwork, get someone to do, you know, proper artwork, approach Designers Republic, see if they'll do the artwork for it. So I went ahead with a lot of this, and I didn't get Designers Republic, didn't get Ian on board. We chatted about it for a while. I think he was doing other things. We hadn't sort of settled upon a price and yada yada. And then I spoke to a friend of mine, and he offered to do it. It would be pro rata. He would do the artwork and I would do a website for him. And so we went along on that basis. I started doing PR. I started taking pre-orders just to make sure that I, you know, have the money. I got in touch with this CD replication company. They did me a fantastic deal. This new guy, I'd used them before for various things, and this guy gave me a price. Oh, that's amazing. That's a really great price. Everything included, the poster and everything. So it was all going great. Then, and I had all the money. I had all the pre-orders, so that was stashed away, and you know, we were good to go. Then I moved to Switzerland. Not to cast aspersions upon my friend who was doing the artwork. He did a great job, and it was going well, and I was working on his website, and then he was like, oh, I want to change this, I want to change that, I want to change this. I'm trying to move to Switzerland. I get to Switzerland. I move here with my ex-girlfriend. That should give you an idea what happened. Two dogs, two cats. Spent thousands of pounds to get here. Relationship going slightly awry. And guy asking, hey, I've done your wipeout ship for your poster. Where's my website? And I'm like, yeah, man, it's crazy. Oh, okay, yeah, don't worry about it. Trying to get the music finished. I'm nearly done with the music. I contact the duplication place, just to, you know, we're going to be going ahead in about 3 months. The guy that promised me the project has been sacked. He's been sacked because he's been doing incorrect quotations. The guy I end up being handed over to says, we can't do it at that price. And I'm like, what? Yeah, it's nearly double, if not more than double.
Right.
But I've already, oh my God, I've already taken the money. I can't go back to people and say, oh, geez. Meanwhile, the relationship does crumble and she goes back to the UK. Just a nightmare. And then I eventually sort of get things sorted out. I tell people there's not going to be a physical CD. I'm really sorry, but there's going to be digital, and I'm going to do the best I can by everybody. And if they want a refund, that's fine. Just say no, screw you. I think out of... there's about 250, 60 people. Might be more than that, actually. Maybe two or three people asked for a refund. And I actually said, don't be shy. Ask for a refund. I will refund you. And, you know, I think I even sent the album to the people that asked for a refund. And then I went back one day to the UK and phoned my mate and said, hey, look, it's all done, all the debacle's over. Let me come over and sit with you and we'll get your website done and then we're all good. And he's like, hey man, I've already paid somebody else to do the website. You can't use the graphics, you owe me money. I was like, oh no. So I lost a girlfriend. I lost him as a friend. My girlfriend, just through logistics, took the dogs and the cats with her as well. So they ended up living with her, which was okay. You know, I got to see them. It was like, you know, she took the kids, man. But I mean, we're still good. You know, we talk a lot. Unfortunately, one of the dogs passed away. But so yeah, that's the debacle.
I was going to say, it certainly sounds like one.
I was nervous breakdown time. It really was bad. And then I released the album, and people loved it. I didn't have anybody. I haven't had. I swear to God, I've not seen a bad review of that album. The only bad review. This is a couple of years later. I decide that I'm gonna really embrace the whole Spotify, Deezer, iTunes, Google Music, Apple Music. Well, you know, you name them all. There's got to be approaching 60 or something like that sites all around the world. Let's do that. Let's do this properly. That was during the COVID lockdown. So they're all out there. All, I think pretty much all my albums you can listen to now on streaming services, which is great because it's like you don't get radio airplay anymore. That doesn't exist. This is what's replaced radio airplay, certainly for people like me who are like, you know, Z-list, if you can even call it celebrity. That's great. And then I went into a wipeout forum on Facebook, and I won't name his name. I won't use his name to save his blushes. But I posted on there as someone had given me admin permissions to this Facebook page. I don't know why. So I just posted on there. Hey, You know, for everybody that's playing Wipeout or any kind of racing game, if you want to listen to some music to chill out afterwards, no pun intended, here's a version of Cold Storage tunes from Wipeout done in a chill out style. So, you know, thumbs up, thumbs up, heart, thumbs up. Oh, this is great, this is great. And then some guy comments, you really should read the rules about posting music in this forum. You have to back it up with a why have you posted it. And whoever wrote this really needs to, you know, that there are other pages where you can post this. I forget what he said, something like lazy ass, something techno, you know, kind of third grade techno or something.
Oof.
So I read it.
Jesus.
I laughed my head off. I was like, oh, that is amazing. So then I went, I can't believe he... And then I looked and I realised I'd posted it as admin. So then I logged back in as Cold Storage and I commented underneath, man, I laughed my head off. This is amazing. I love this. And then I quoted him as like third-rate techno or whatever. I said, that is just the best review I've ever had. So then he replied... you can imagine how I'm feeling. I'm now the troll who's being accosted by the guy I'm trolling. And he said, but can you kind of see what I'm saying about, you know, and he sort of discussed bits of the tracks or the album or whatever, where he felt what he felt. I said, hey man, that's perfect. You know, if people genuinely love it and they say, I really love this music, that fills my heart with warmth and, you know, it's great. If someone says, it's all right, that's just as good. If someone says, I effing hate this, it's horrible, then I don't know why, but I find that entertaining. I want to know kind of, you know, why, where are they coming from? Are they coming from the same place that I came from back when Nick Burkham asked me to create the Wipeout music and I was thinking, God, anything but that style. So I think that's the only bad review I've seen, but it was great, yeah.
Oh yeah, it is really awesome stuff, and obviously you did a lot of music for Wipeout, but one of the things I definitely wanted to ask about was that you did some of the sound design as well.
Yes. It was de rigueur. It was like if you're creating the audio in quotes for a game, that means you're creating the audio. I mean, sort of what, rewind a bit more, you might be asked to do the sound driver as well. So, and convert the samples and do all the looping and maybe do some compression. And I don't mean audio compression. I mean, you know, like zip, you know, raw, that kind of compression. Yeah, it's you just expect it. It's like, oh, you're working on this game now. Okay, you know, what sound effects do you need? What kind of music? Da, da, da. So when it came to Wipeout, it was just, okay, so we've got these flying ships. They're going to need rocket sounds. They're going to need missile sounds and so on. Nick says, I want it to be like arcadey, so there's announcements. You know, 3, 2, 1, go! you know, and missile and all that kind of thing.
Absolutely.
So when it came to that, I think it was Mike that suggested it. He said, why don't we do it robotic style? So we used the Amiga's voice synthesizer to say all the key phrases, and then we passed it through a mild distortion, a chorus, compressed it a little bit, maybe added some reverb, and that's... Those are the vocals from, you know, the original. And all the weapon sound effects and everything, they're all just synthesizers and sample CDs, and you sort of mess around with things until they sort of roughly sound right. Then you think, okay, now it's got to fit within this memory constraint because there's only so much sample space within that the sound chip can access in the PlayStation 1. So that was... It was just expected, and that's what we did. And then for Wipeout 2097, I think we went, as far as I can remember, we went vocal. I think there is a 3, 2, 1, go! which is me just sounding radio presenter.
Yeah.
And that's the other thing. I think the other vocal that I did was in the title animation. At the end, when the ships burst through the screen and it goes, wipe out! So I just recorded myself doing the loudest kind of whispered wipe out I could do, and then compressed that to make it sound a bit more dramatic. It wasn't, I've got to do the sound effects as well. It's just like I'm expected to do the sound effects. It was an inspired choice by Mike to suggest using the Amiga.
Well, it's because later down the line in this particular racing special, there's a lot of like in-depth conversations about recording like actual F1 cars and things like that. So I was particularly interested in like how you were pulling those sound effects together, because I assume it was a bit more of a creative thing. Like, as you say, you were manipulating different samples and synth sounds as opposed to like recording straight engines.
Yeah, definitely for Wipeout. And something that became very apparent very quickly was if you have a screaming rocket engine going throughout the entire game, it's actually kind of like Chinese water torture. It's horrible. So after a couple of failed experiments, just literally in the studio, just watching a bit of compressed video of the game, I realized that we could just... the soundscape within the game could be occupied by the music largely, and the sound effects, you know, when you fly over the pickups and shields come in and explosions and so on. If for the ships themselves, I think we just used two different layered sounds, or maybe three, but all occupying the sort of mid to high range. So you've just got the... as you go faster, there's a wind, like a pink noise. People that don't know what pink noise is, white noise is just literally full spectrum, you know, that horrible thing you get on an old TV when there's no channel. Pink noise is a slightly narrower band, so it's kind of filtered. That's like a sweep through. So if you pick one of those points, so, you know, you sort of want like a kind of noise. There was a bit of a whine noise as well for the turbines, and then a bit of a rocket noise, but nothing too crazy. So when you blend all that together, and in fact if you turn the music off on the original Wipeout, you'll hear that's, you know, the engines are very top end, and not, they just give you a sense that you're moving. So yeah, I think I did lean on a couple of samples of a taxiing, I forget which actual aeroplane it was, Boeing, you know, something, Boeing 747 or whatever, a sample CD of one of those just sat on the runway, just taxiing, so that you've just got the as it's, you know, waiting to take off, which is great because it's a fixed pitch and it's fairly easy to find a loop. And then the rest was kind of like more synthetic, really.
Right, no, that's honestly a completely perfect rundown of that kind of thing. It's just looking at my questions at the moment, I'm honestly a little bit concerned about time, because I don't want to take up too much of your time this evening, because I know it's already late for you.
No, you're okay.
Okay, well cool, because at the moment I've still got quite a few things to get through on the racing stuff, and then like a lot of Amiga questions as well.
I'll try to stop digressing.
No, it's not that, because honestly, that is all perfect stuff. I'm just really worried about taking up too much of your time, because this is exactly the kind of in-depth chats I like to get.
All right, well, let's set a rough 30 minutes. And I can also chase up where my pizza is, because I was expecting a doorbell chime, but I guess something went wrong. But anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, but no hassle. Let's sort of forge ahead, let's say about another half hour.
Okay, yeah.
And then, yeah.
Well, I wanted to get your thoughts directly on like the introduction of licensed music and stuff, because Wipeout's kind of a key game in that, in the growth of licensed music in video games. And I've actually, through all the people I've interviewed, there's like a completely different feelings across the board. Like some people embrace it and love it and actually have worked on the curated soundtracks and stuff, and others really hate it and feel uncomfortable with it and feel like it's taking jobs away. So where do you stand as the composer on Wipeout?
Historically, I think, was Jean-Michel Jarre the first licensed piece of music? I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. I think that was on an Amiga game.
It's interesting.
I think so.
I know I've heard conversions of Jarre by Ben Daglish, but I don't know if that's the same thing.
I don't think Jarre ever knew about those, to be honest.
No, of course not. No.
And certainly the likes of Rob Hubbard, he did a lot of maybe not direct rip-offs, but in certain cases very, very similar to a lot of sort of well-known bits of electronic music. But yeah, in terms of, hello, Mr. Musician, can we license your music? I'm pretty sure Jarre was licensed for some Amiga game, or maybe a PC game, back in the day. Maybe there were others, spot incidents. Rick Wakeman did the soundtrack for Microcosm, but only on the FM Towns machine. So, yeah. Which is annoying, because he often gets credited for the... the Mega CD version that I did. Yeah. Cracking Music and Sound Effects by Rick Wakeman.
Credits in video games are always like that, though. They can be so all over the place.
Well, the credits, the actual credits were fine. And I think, Moby Something Bomb or whatever.
I tend to rely on Moby myself.
Giant Bomb,
yeah.
Is it? Is it Giant Bomb?
Yeah, I think that's
they
right.
They are correct. It's just some of the reviews. So people would greet me in the morning at Psygnosis. Morning, Rick. I said, oi, it's Mr. Wakeman to you. In fact, I think on one of my albums, did I call one of them the Wakeman mix or something like that, or the Rick mix, just as a sort of like a jibe towards him. Licensed music. When I first was assigned the task of writing the music for Wipeout, and then they announced to me that they were getting licensed musicians on board, I thought, well, what's the point? I'll do the sound effects. You get the licensed music in. Good luck to you. You know, whatever. I suppose my nose was a little bit out of joint, but I understood. You know, I had the wherewithal to understand that they needed, as well as it being a great game, they needed marketing weight. So if they had all these licensed bands that people like, then you know, it's more fuel to the fire. And when they approached a lot of the bands, and only a few of them were interested, and in the end they got three, I think it was for the first Wipeout, and they said to me, oh, we're going to need... You know, I thought maybe one or two tracks. We're going to need like six, seven, eight, however many tracks you can do. Quick, smart, come on. Let's. I was like, well, yeah, that's all well and good, isn't it? When you can't get your license tracks, you come back to Tim and he's got to pull his finger out of wherever. And yeah, so there was a little bit of that. And then to add injury to insult, I remember being asked to go to do PR work. So I was sent off to a few different magazines, and then there was one round robin interview I did with, I forget which magazine it was, and they had four or five games musicians, and I was instructed by marketing to talk about Wipeout, talk it up. I was like, yeah, okay. The article came out and the head of marketing came down to me and was livid. What have you done? I said, what? Have you read this review? No, I haven't seen it. And he'd highlighted a bit in the review, because it was all, you know, the interviewer would ask a question and then the answers would come from each of the musicians. Then he'd ask another question, hence, you know, round robin. And he'd said something like, so you're looking forward to doing the music for Wipeout? And I said, yeah, absolutely. I said, obviously, we've gone out to various bands and asked them to join us and contribute music, you know, the likes of Left Field, Orbital, Chemical Brothers. Look, you've named names. And I said, yeah. He goes, We had plans to reveal this. It was part of this, you know, the whole marketing strategy. Who's going to be on the game? And you've just given it away. And I was like, okay, but you didn't give me any instruction. You just said, go there and hype it up. Oh, I mentioned it. You've just wrecked it. And he walked away. And I got quite upset about that. And so I went up to one of the managing directors of the company and I told him what happened. And I said, I don't think that's fair. So then the marketing guy came back down and said, oh, sorry, I lost the plot there a bit. You know, it's not the end of the world. Yeah, so... and then when it came to... I think he sort of apologetically came along and said, hey, look, I'm sorry, you know, value your input and blah, blah, blah. And do you know what? There's going to be a vinyl record and a CD. So how does that sound? I was like, wow, I'm going to be a published musician. This is great. And then the CD came out and it was the three tracks that were licensed and then just a raft of other music. None of my tracks. So I went up to him and I showed him the CD. I said, what happened there? And he goes, I don't know anything about it. Phone the record label. So I phoned the record label. I said, can I speak to whoever's responsible? Well, you know, finally got through to this guy. And he went, who are you? And I said, Cold Storage. You know, did the music for Wipeout. I've never heard of you. I said, well, no, I'm an in-house musician, but I contributed the bulk of the music to the game. Yeah, but you're not marketable, mate. Can you imagine somebody going into a shop and they're like, oh, Chemical Brothers, Left Field, Orbital, and then what, 7-8 tracks by Cold Storage, who the hell is that? Oh, this must be one of those cheap albums you find in the bucket at the end of the month. Okay, fair enough. Wipeout 2097 comes out, I'm promised again. Yeah, you'll go on the CD this time. People know you, they love you, you're getting fan mail, it's fine. I've told the record label. Look, speak to them, isn't it? Speak to, I don't know, Jeff or whoever at the record label. Yeah, man, yeah, love your stuff on the first one. I said, look, I've only got two tracks anyway. Yeah, no, both are going on. Don't you worry. At least one, but definitely, you know, I reckon we can get two on them. Oh, great. Album comes out. No Cold Storage to be seen. So I phoned him, I said, hey, what happened? Not enough space on the CD makes. Oh, awfully sorry. And I went, oh, okay, fair enough. Took that at face value, and then I put it in the CD player, and it was like, I don't know. I literally don't know the exact length, but it was something like 54 minutes. And I was like, nah, you can fit more than 54 minutes on a CD. I eventually found out that it was a legal issue. It was actually because I worked for Sony Games, they would have to liaise through Sony Music, and it was just, nah, it wasn't going to happen. Yeah, so that was my experience of being involved with sort of licensed acts and me and games. And so it was great. I mean, there was hobnobbing with these bands. I got invited to concerts and live performances where they were playing. I actually got to be pretty good friends with the Orbital guys. Definitely Paul, you know, visited his house down in Brighton a few times, and he's a really, really sweet guy. Tom and Ed, Chemical Brothers, got to meet them a few times.
I grew up on all these artists, that's so cool.
Yeah, I mean, they were really nice. We didn't really hit it off, because, like, slightly different mindset, but it was great to sort of see where they were coming from. And they said, oh, come on stage when we're performing. He said, you just won't believe the vibe. I'm like, literally on the stage? He went, yeah. So I think we were at Cream in Liverpool and got on stage with them as they went to the gear, and then, you know, they started sort of playing the set, they were sort of into the second song, and I was like really getting into it. I'd had a little bit to drink, so I was just on the front of the stage, just, you know, dancing and looking stupid or whatever. And then this girl just was at the front of the stage, and she just lifted her top up and was bouncing her boobs around and smiling at me. And I thought, it's a different world, isn't it?
Yeah.
And she was not wearing a bra. So it was like, oh, so. Yeah. So there was that side to it. I'm trying to think. We went to a left field gig as well. That was insane. I'm digressing again, but I'll just tell you this. This is with Mike Clark as well. He got invited. We arrived early because we had AAA pass, and they were doing the sound check. Oh my God, the bass was insane. It was at this old theatre in Liverpool, and I said, that is a good sound. They had it set up as I would have. The bass was really heavy, the mid-range and the top not so much. You don't come from there deaf. And I said to the engineer, the front of house guy, I said, I like how you've mixed that. It's really sweet. And he said, oh, that's only at half volume. This is just to get it. He said, the police were called to our gig in Glasgow, I think it was. We had to turn it down. I said, all right. He said, but we should be okay here. So, oh my God. So anyway, they had a warm-up act, and they kept it at that volume for the warm-up act. And then, Left Field came on, and they ramped the volume up. You could hardly breathe. The bass was like rocking your chest backwards and forwards. And then I'd had so much water to drink, I thought I was popped to the loos. And as I was walking towards the loo, Mike was coming from there. We'd lost each other kind of in the melee. And I said to him, oh my God, it's so hot in there. I could just, the sweat's dripping down off the ceilings onto me. And he said, it isn't, mate. And I'm like, what do you mean? I said, I'm covered in water. He goes, no, you're not. You're covered in plaster. Oh, and I went into the loos and I looked in the mirror, and I just had plaster dust all over my head because the bass had been shaking the plaster off the ceiling. I got to go to a lot of gigs, quite a few Orbital ones, free albums, blah, blah, blah. Who you know, not what you know. It was fun. So all told, for me, personal experience-wise, there was a bit of crap, but ultimately, looking back, it was a good thing, personally speaking. And I finally did get music on an album. There was a bit of a hiatus, then I did a track for Wipeout Pure on the PSP, and they released that as a CD. And a stipulation of me getting involved, they said, oh, would you do as a track for Wipeout Pure? I said, yes. This is how much it's going to cost you. I get to keep the ownership of the song. And this is purposely, I want ownership of the song because I want to be a proper artist on the compilation CD. And they went, yeah, okay. Signed it. CD came through the post. Tim Wright, Cold Storage, finally in an album. So that was quite a moment. So yeah, it all told for me, it wasn't a bad thing. I've talked to other musicians that it's left a bad taste in the mouth because they're a software house, they were the in-house musician, and then it's just so easy to go to, not necessarily a well-known artist, you could just go to a record label, and maybe not one of the top record labels, maybe a dance label or a drum and bass label or a rock label, and they have a load of artists that they want to get out there. So maybe they'll even do it for free. Because in my other life, as the guy that created music for PlayStation, MTV Music Generator, and all those music creation packages that were on PlayStation, we did that. I said, I said to Codemasters, hey, let's try and get some licensed acts on here that will really give it an extra added dimension, not just in terms of samples and stuff, but demo tracks. Maybe we could do a video on there as well. So we got in touch with a record label and they said, oh yeah, we've got an act that are completely unknown, but we think they're great and we think they're going to do good things. So we're like, okay, yeah, let's hear them. And I wasn't sold on it. But then I thought, no, actually, these are interesting because they're not rock, they're not dance, they're kind of like a weird blend. So maybe it'll just tick everybody's boxes in an average kind of way. So they gave us a video, they gave us a song, and they also said they'd help us launch the product in London. At the Virgin Megastore, when that existed. I don't think it does now. And so in the time between us agreeing to that and signing it up, and it didn't cost as much, and actually doing the launch at Virgin Megastore, the Gorillaz became a thing. So when we did the launch at the Virgin Megastore, they had this huge Gorillaz poster, you know, Damon Alban and all that, and we were riding on the coattails of that. So sometimes it's a real blessing. In that instance, it definitely was.
Absolutely. And I'm glad you brought up those Music Generation things, because it kind of leads me to say that the way things are looking, I wondered whether you might be up for a second conversation at some point. It could be any time in the next couple of months where we could fill in on some of the PlayStation and Amiga questions that I had.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah, because honestly, there's so much I wanted to talk about there, because I played a lot of those music games and actually EJ as well, so I had some good questions lined up for that.
Well, if you want to do something along those lines, it would probably be a good idea to get my brother, Lee, involved in that kind of interview. And potentially one of the artists that worked on there, Paul Vera Broadbent, he's going to have some stories connected to that.
Well, that would be interesting, definitely. Definitely.
Yeah.
I'm sure
they'd be up for it as well. Yeah.
Yeah, we'd have to sort that out. And we definitely need to talk about some of your Amiga stuff as well, because I've got an Amiga episode coming up as well.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But we'll stay in touch. As long as you're always up for it, then we'll get there in the end, because I've always got loads of episodes I'm working on.
Honestly, and this isn't meant to sound egomaniacal or big-headed, but I've turned down a lot of interviews over the last few years. Partly because of so much work, because I'm heading up NumFum in Switzerland. I'm still running my company Tantra Media. I'm still producing music for Cold Storage, and I've got personal stuff that I have to be doing, like in a new relationship that was happening a few years back, and obviously the split from the girlfriend and yada 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 yada, you know. Mm-hmm. So life was crazy and full, and I certainly wasn't in a position to good headspace to talk. So I don't know when the last interview was. It's been a while. But when you contacted me, I thought, go on, Tim, stop being so antisocial.
Well, that's great, because it's great to have you on board, because this series I'm working on is massive. I've been working on it for a long time now, and it's really great to have your input on the racing stuff, because Wipeout's a key title. And on the Amiga stuff, there's lots of stuff we could talk about. And then I've got another episode about like PlayStation audio and where mm-hmm. everything went with that. So and the Music Generation stuff was just fascinating. So I thought we could catch up on that another time. Then we could spend like these last 15 minutes mopping up these racing questions, and there wouldn't be any stress.
Yeah.
Excellent. So in that case, then, I don't know how much of a sore spot this is after talking about all that license stuff. But how did you feel then about Wipeout 3, and had it gone too far by that point?
I think from my perspective, it wasn't an issue, because chronologically, I worked on Wipeout. I'm trying to think what else. The Tellurian Defense. I think a couple of other games. Formula One, I think, was after that. And then there was a truck. There was a truck thing. There were a few games after that. Then there was Wipeout 2097. And then my brother approached me and said, would you advise us on starting up a software development house? The guy I'm working with, who develops business software, has got a load of spare cash. He doesn't want the tax man to get it all. He wants to spend it on something. And I've suggested make a game for PlayStation or something. I was like, oh yeah, that sounds interesting. So they got a guy to run it, and then I was advising the guy, and I was getting a bit of spare cash for doing it, and some nice meals and everything. And then he stopped talking to me. This guy just disappeared. So then after about 2 weeks, I contacted my brother. I said, I guess he got all the information he needed. He said, no, we've sacked him. He's useless. We don't think he's the man for the job. I said, no, that's a waste. And he said, yeah, will you do it? And I was like, I don't know. I was quite having, you know, the time of my life, sat at Psygnosis, all the toys, writing music. And then I thought, nah, maybe the time has come. Let's, you know, sounds like fun. So we had a chat about what we could do, and we had a few ideas for games. And then I said, hey, you know what would be really cool was if we were to create a music writing package, like Noise Tracker or Pro Tracker on the Amiga, but for the PlayStation. You know, 24 channels, loads of extra RAM, CD quality samples, blah, blah, blah. So that, at that point, that's where I left Psygnosis to create Jester Interactive. And so my marriage to the Wipeout franchise, well, it wasn't a divorce as such, there was a separation. And kind of like, on the side, I finished the music off for Tellurian Defense. That was the last bit of music I did for Psygnosis. And I lost touch with what was going on with Wipeout, because I had a new baby, I had a new thing to concentrate on. And funnily enough, when I say I had a new baby, I literally did. My son was born around the time that we were getting Jester Interactive off the ground, and I was working like 2-3 days straight without sleep. It was a really bad time to be having a new baby. I played the games occasionally, but I lost touch with that. I stayed in touch with the fan base, so that was a thing. And I would get the occasional message or email saying, hey, there's a new Wipeout coming out, are you on it? And I'm like, no, I'm way too busy doing other things at the moment. Oh, but you should be on it. I was like, even if they ask me, I haven't got the time. So I think, it took until Wipeout Pure. And I was still meeting with the guys, you know, from Psygnosis, and they were saying, oh yeah, I've got a new Wipeout coming out, come up to the test department, have a bit of a play and see what you think. So I did see it, but I wasn't really that involved. And then I was approached when they had the PSP version, will you do the music, or do as a track, because there's been a lot of requests from your fan base if we could have a Cold Storage track, which, you know, that's lovely. So I think, it's to answer your question, it's not really something that crossed my mind. I just kind of thought, well, they're going to get somebody else to do the music. I think Mike Clark may have left at that point as well, so I don't think they had any in-house musicians.
Yeah, they got a guy called DJ Sasha on board, who basically also curated this massive soundtrack of licensed stuff, which is what I kind of meant by had it gone too far by that point.
I don't know. I think, honestly, I think the death knell had rung for in-house musicians round that about that time, because the marketplace for people like me, because between Jester Interactive and a few companies, Jester Interactive, Checkmate Solutions, Tantra Media, in amongst all of that period of time, early 2000s, going up to 2010-ish, I did actually consider going back in-house, and the only jobs there were dedicated sound engineers. So you'd go out, record Formula One cars and so on, and then edit them and splice them together. Or management, go in and manage a team or manage the audio. And there weren't any, there weren't really in-house musicians. I think David Whittaker was the last guy that I recall being an in-house musician, and even in his role at Traveller's Tales as the in-house musician, and I'm using air quotes here, he would just chop up and edit the existing music from like Star Wars or whatever, for Star Wars Lego and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think it died. I think in-house musicians died. Aside from indie, you know, anybody that was doing an indie game. I got quite a few requests for music for various indie games on smartphones. Not so much PlayStation or Xbox. Well, yeah, one or two actually. And some weird PC games. Even a couple of Facebook games when that was a thing.
Well, that kind of thing leads me to, like, there was these titles, Slipstream GX and Pacer, which were, like, worked on by Wipeout development team guys, if I'm not wrong.
Yes. I won't say a sore spot, but a bit of an embarrassment. Slipstream GX approached me and said, would I do some music? And I did contribute a track. I think it's called Torvolution. And a few months later, I'd forgotten about it, because I think I gave it to them for free. I'd forgotten about it, and then I thought, oh, I need a name for my music. I can't put Wipeout. What could I put? And all the names are going through my head, and then Slipstream came into my head. I thought, oh, that's good, because I always loved that film with... his name slipped my mind. Luke Skywalker.
Mark Hamill.
Mark Hamill. Yeah, you can tell it's getting late. Mark Hamill, he was in a film called Slipstream, where he had this amazing beard and bleach blonde hair and flew this weird-looking plane. That's what I was thinking, not, oh, I'll steal Slipstream GX's name.
Right.
Put that on my albums. And one of the guys that was part of the Slipstream team contacted me like months later and said, hey, downloaded your albums, really, really cool. Glad we could provide you with a name or something. And I was like, oh, God, yeah. Oh, God, yeah. So gave them a track. Pacer, I'm providing music for, and I've also provided sound effects for. And, my involvement with them is quite deep. In fact, I had a chat with one of the bosses who's putting up the money, literally 3 hours ago.
Yeah, because that's an ongoing project, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's going great guns, and it looks good. It really does. I'll be honest, and he might not like me saying this, but when I first was approached and I saw some of the initial graphics, I thought, yeah, looks all right. It's like it's not amazing, but it looks capable, and the physics is sort of okay. Maybe needs a tweak here and there. And then that guy disappeared. It all went very quiet. I'd contributed two tracks, and then this other guy got in touch and said, oh yeah, things have changed, new management, take a look at this is how it looks now. And I was like, wow, that looks a lot better, and we want you to do way more tracks.
Oh, that sounds great. Yeah, that sounds wonderful.
So I'm really happy to be involved with that, and I've tried not to make the music sound too Wipeout-y. For instance, there was a game called Sodium 2, which was in PlayStation Home, I think, created by Outso Entertainment. And how many tracks did I contribute to that? I think it was three. And that's a very Wipeout-y kind of anti-gravity thing, but I deliberately went a different style. And I created 6E6132, that album, and that features the songs from that game plus some mixes and additional songs. So I'm trying to do the same with Pacer. It's like, oh, that sounds like Cold Storage a bit. Yeah, well, but I don't want it to sound too much like Wipeout. So I hope I've done okay there.
Absolutely, that sounds so cool. And just as we finish up then, I just kind of have a couple of quick questions about some of the more obscure games, if that's okay.
Yeah.
On the racing front. Because you mentioned that Formula One game, which, if I'm not wrong, was released in 1996.
Yes.
Sounds about
right, yeah.
And Formula One is one of the concentrations of this racing special that I'll be doing, and sound effects for it in general, which is what you did. So how were you approaching sound effects for a Formula One game in 1996?
Well, I'm not going to steal anybody's thunder. I wasn't actually responsible for the sound effects. I did certain aspects of the... Oh, hang on a minute. I was just checking it was still recording. My screen went blank.
No problem.
It's still recording. Cool. Largely my input on the Formula One thing was there was an intro movie, so I did the music and the sound effects and all that kind of thing for that intro. I think I did sound effects for the interface as well, but the actual recording of the Formula One engines and all that kind of thing, I'm trying to It would be on Moby Games, who was credited for doing that. They may have done it in-house at Bizarre Creations. Or maybe even Mike Clark did it. You'll have to Google that.
Yeah, because I know Mike Clark did work on some Formula One at the time, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, just double-check that. But from my recollection, I did not work on the sound effects, aside from maybe some of the interface sounds and definitely all the audio for the... I'm trying to think which one it was. It was the one where there's a Formula One car and I don't think it moves. The doors open and you're panning around it and it's all really atmospheric, and then you hear crowd noise in the background and you hear the revving of the engine. So that was my contribution there. So maybe that's a nice quick question.
No, that's good, because this kind of leads into two other ones which are all on the same kind of thing. And it kind of moves into the noughties. You mentioned some monster truck games, and there was a superbike game as well. Again, you were working on the sound effects. So, again, always just interested in the evolution of your approach to sound effects with each decade, really.
Okay, so in total, let's think. I'll try and round everything up into this.
There was tabletop racing as well, so I'll just chuck that in there quickly.
Yeah, okay, so let me see if I can juggle all these in my head. I'm going to say them all now so that we can sort of refer back, or you can hopefully help me. So there's tabletop racing, there's Sega racing.
Yeah, I saw a credit for that, but couldn't actually locate anything deeper on what you actually did. So
yeah. There's that. There's the TT, Isle of Man, and Classic TT that the Jester Interactive did. One of their final products, I think, before they... Well, they haven't ceased trading, but before they stopped releasing titles. And also whilst at Jester Interactive, there's the Super Trucks. So I think that's everything. Engine-based... yeah, off the top of my head, I think that's right. So, in terms of recording motorcycles, I was really lucky. I went to the Honda testing facility, and we had some current bikes, some vintage bikes. These were actually sort of championship-winning bikes that they put some oil in, unless it was a dry clutch, put some fuel in and got them warmed up outside, and then... I didn't really nearly die, but I was very ill. They put me in this soundproofed booth with the bikes on a rolling road and this big extractor fan pulling out all the carbon monoxide. It didn't. There's me with these microphones and a four-track recorder, a digital recorder, and these microphones are rated... at a dB level where you could record a Harrier jump jet taking off, and they needed to be, because some of these older bikes were insane. They had no baffle. It was literally just like explosions going off several a second, because that's what it is. And I'm in the room. I've got headphones on, monitoring headphones, but they don't protect your ears that well. So apart from being deafened in this enclosed space, I was also being gassed. So I did that for about an hour and a half. I was ill the next day, banging headache. So great, amazing, wonderful venue, privileged to see these bikes, but unfortunately kind of slightly tainted by the illness. And then trips to Isle of Man, trips to Northern Ireland. My God, I could tell you some tales about that and cover a whole episode, I think.
Yeah.
Possibly couldn't name names, but anyway, yeah, so we recorded a lot of these old motorcycles. I got some amazing recordings, and I was given permission to own them, like, well, not personally, but my company Tantra Media, as well as licensing them kind of out to Jester for their games. So then when it came to the Sega racing, I got approached out of the blue. Someone had seen my... Or was it word of mouth, I think? I think Bob and Barn, those guys, they recommended me, maybe. And I just got approached by this producer, and she said, oh, apparently you do, you know, motorcycle racing engines, and we need some for Sega Racing. I'm like, yeah, okay. Was it Sonic Sega Racing or something?
Yeah, Sonic and Sega All-Stars Racing.
Yeah, so I said, well, what do you need? And they said, oh, we've got like a chopper and we've got this and that and the other. So I sent them over what I thought was a good selection. They chose a few and I got paid. I never saw the game. It was literally just supply the samples. I don't even own a copy of it.
Well, now I know, because as I say, it was impossible to find out what you did for that. So now I know.
Yeah, oh, maybe that's why. Maybe she presented them as her recordings. I don't know. So it wasn't important for me to be listed as a contributor. Tabletop racing, I did the sound effects for the cars and some musical stings as well. For, you know, when you do this and do that, win the championship and so on. And then the in-game music was provided by somebody else. Pretty good stuff. I missed a trick there as well. I'm sure Nick Birkin won't mind me saying, but when he approached me, he said, will you do it? And I said, yeah, sure. And he said, look, this is a new venture, blah, blah, blah. You know, would you take shares in it? You know, kind of like a percentage royalty rather than money. And I was like, oh, this could fail. And I wasn't saying I was on the bare bones of my bum at that point, but I could do with the money because I had a kid and, you know, all that kind of thing. So I said, well, what if it's money, but, you know, it's only X amount? And he went, yeah, we can manage that. Oh, that was such a poor business deal. I said to him one day, I said, you know, when you offered me, I don't know how many percentage it was of the, and he went, oh, God, I did, didn't I? He said, I'm glad I didn't. I said, yeah, I'm not. So that was that. So we've done the motorbikes, we've done the Sega, we've done tabletop racing. Ah, yeah, monster trucks. So that was fun. I hired a recorder, a good microphone, a couple of good microphones, and one of those wind jammer, windproofing things for the microphone. You know, you see them outside broadcast and then suddenly the microphone will just dip into view and it's this just big furry muff thing.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, so that stops the wind noise. So we went to this racing track and we had this monster truck flying around the track. And I was on the corner of one of the the chicane areas, getting some nice pass shots, you know, of the truck going by. And eventually some guy came over to me. And he said, after the truck had gone by twice, and he came over and he said, hey, mate. I said, what? He goes, have you got a death wish? And I said, why? he goes, they come off here a lot, you know. And I said, do they? And he went, oh, yeah, right where you're standing. I'd back up a bit if I were you. So I said, yeah, but I want a close-up sound. Anyway, so eventually the guy in the truck said, well, you should come in the truck with me. And, you know, you can record it through the window and in the cab. And I said, oh, yeah, great. So I did that. Oh, my God, that was quite terrifying. And then I said, okay, I will need some idling sounds now. So he said, okay. So we parked up. And then I got this furry muff thing right up against near the exhaust pipe and near the engine. I said, okay, can you do me some revs, you know, so we could get that in there as well. So he said, yeah, put it up against the engine. Vroom, vroom. And then I put it near the microphone. Vroom, put the microphone near the exhaust. Vroom, and the windjammer melted.
Right.
It just ate it for breakfast. So that cost us, I think it was 90 odd quid to replace this piece of fur. So, but otherwise, quite an exciting day again. I've just had a flashback, actually. I did record Formula One car engines. See, this shows that I'm maybe approaching senility.
It is 25 years ago.
It is. Why didn't I remember this before? No, I didn't record any Formula One engines. Yes, you did, Tim. I went with the guys from Bizarre Creations, and we went in a car down to Silverstone. We spent the day there. I recorded the cars going past. The reason I don't remember it so well, in terms of you asking me did I contribute, was I don't think they got used. The end results weren't as fantastic as we were expecting, so I think they did them again. That's why it sort of didn't register in my logical thought process. But I did go... that was it. We went in the morning and did the car recording. We broke for lunch, and then I went back there with the guy that managed the audio team at Psygnosis, a guy called Phil Morris. Now, he'd been in touch with Murray Walker and had said, look, Murray, we're going to... And Murray Walker provided, you know, the vocals, obviously. Here comes PK, he's in the lead, that kind of thing. And so he said, hey, Murray, we'll be down at, you know, Silverstone. You're going to be there. Yes. We might pop by and say hello. Oh, yeah, sure, okay. So we recorded, we had lunch. Phil says, hey, let's go and get some, you know, sound bites from Murray Walker. Okay, so we wander over to the pit area. We're stopped by two burly guards. We've got these lanyards that say, you know, special access area B, C and D or whatever. And you can't go in there. Why? That's the VIP viewing lounge, blah, blah, blah. Oh, it's just we're meant to be seeing Murray Walker. Oh, okay. We'll phone him. So then nothing happens. We stood there for ages. This is ridiculous. I've got Murray's mobile. I'll phone him. Phones him. Hi, Murray. Yeah, and I had my DAT tape recorder, obviously, for recording the engines. So I thought, I'll record this kind of meetup. So I had it recording. And you can hear Philip Morris going, yeah, hi, Murray, it's Phil. Yeah, Phil Morris. Phil Morris from Psygnosis. You know, we're doing the formula. Yeah, that, yeah, Phil, yeah. Can we have a quick chat? If it's convenient. Yeah, we've tried getting, he won't let us in. Our passes don't cover it. Oh, yeah, if you would. Okay, oh, thanks so much. Okay, bye. I said, was he not happy? No, he seemed a bit annoyed that he had to come out here. So then he came to the fence and he said, it's okay, these guys are with me, they can come in. No, they can't. The passes have to say they can come in. Yes, but I'm vouching for them. No, Murray, I know who you are, but I don't know who these are. I'm sorry, lads, you can't come in. Oh, all right then. And I'm busy, so, yeah. Enjoy yourselves anyway, and then, yeah, sorry about that. And he just walked off. So that was kind of embarrassing. Yeah. So I did record some Formula One engines, but they never got used. I think that's all of them.
Well, yeah, it seems like you've managed to cover just about all of it.
Yeah. I don't think I've ever recorded any jet engines, any helicopters...
There's still time.
There is still time. I'll tell you, this is really just a tidbit. It's probably boring. The first engine that I actually recorded was an engine turning over. It was from my Austin Allegro and a 1.5 HLS. I was doing the Pugs in Space demo. And I'm not sure if you're aware of that demo, but in there, Pugsy eventually tries to fix his spaceship and he's trying to start the spaceship. So I thought it would be funny if he's got an old starter motor in there. So I went down to my Allegro, pulled the coil off the top of the engine so there was no chance of it starting, got an old cassette recorder, put the microphone in there, and then that went into the demo. So that was my very first foray into recording engines.
That's so cool to hear. And I was going to start off my set of Amiga questions by asking about Pugs in Space, so that's okay. Great, we can lead off with that next time.
Right, so yeah, so there you go, that's the first engine. And the last engine was Northern Ireland, recording a vintage motorcycle that some guy had brought to us on the day, part of his private collection. That's a small soupçon of the kind of things that I've experienced through my gaming career. There's much more of that, much worse. I can't possibly say any more or name names, but I don't know. Maybe if you interview me about the music creation side of things, I might let slip a few Jester Interactive tales, but my God.
Well, we'll see what happens there in future conversations.
I might get into trouble, actually, if I do, but we'll see.
I'll try and keep you on the straight and narrow if
Please
I can.
Please do, yeah.
As the host, yeah. Well, thank you so much.
No problem. Now I'll go and chase that pizza. Where's it?
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm feeling
bad for you.
Unless it's on the doorstep, it's freezing cold.
Yeah, we'll find out.
Yeah, great.
Good luck with the pizza, Tim, and thanks again.
Yeah, okay. You too.
Bye for now.
Take care.